Tom Gimbel joins us once again from LaSalle Group. How are you today, Tom?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Pretty good. You are the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Pardon me. I just wanted to read you this from Business Insider. Gen Z workers are interrogating managers. Workers interrogating the managers about work-life balance in job interviews. A recruiter was left a little puzzled and awed after interviewing a Gen Z applicant who said he was looking for a five-hour workday and a $600 stipend up front. Samira Khan, an India-based director of people success at Infido, that's an employee experience platform, wrote about the experience on Twitter. The post has more than 700,000 views and has sparked a debate about behavior at work. One poster said, I hire Gen Z every quarter, and they cannot take the pressure at all, but they do expect a lot of money. They're creative, but they're taking their jobs for granted. But one more note here. Another disagreed, saying, thank God, at least Gen Z is setting up expectations and not agreeing to be a corporate slave with no life and all work. Good for them. What's Tom Gimbel say about all of this?
Number one, I love when people combine words like corporate and slave, where the definition of slave is being owned and not being paid. And to work in a corporation, you get paid and you can quit and you can leave whenever you want. So, you know, the dynamic of that phrase baffles me. I think this is a much ado about nothing. I think you've got this situation where through social media and what have you, a couple people get famous and they get some clickbait and what goes on. Is there a change in Gen Z versus previous ones? Yes, there is. And there was with Gen X, and there was with Gen Y, and with millennials and everything else. There always is. And we've got to accept that. The key is you don't throw out the barrel because of one bad apple. And there's a lot of good young 20-somethings that want to be in an office. They want to work. They want to be motivated. They want to be inspired. And those are good qualities.
Yeah. But I think the underlying issue here, this nonsense of one person notwithstanding, is the balance of work and the balance of life. And it does seem that this, look, the object of the game isn't to make the most money or make the company the most profitable. The object of the game is to be happy. So if a five-hour workday and less pay, or an eight-hour workday from home and I'm not going to think about it in the ninth hour, makes you happy, more power to you. I mean, that's the object of the game, right, Tom?
I think you confused a couple things, John. I think number one, the rules of the game are whatever matters to you. And depending on what matters to you, you've got to play by the rules of the person that is in charge.
Yes.
And so the challenge is, if you only want to work 5 hours a day and you don't care about money, then yeah, there's a lot of options for you. But the problem is, and I think what a lot of people who counter what the article was, is that a lot of people want to get paid a lot of money and do not a lot of work, or not do it for a long time, or do it on their time, not somebody else's. Mm-hmm. And that's just not how life works, quite frankly. And I think that what we've gotten is, you know, there are a lot of negative effects aside from the long-term unknown health effects from COVID. And one of them is it messed with a lot of people's head and a lot of corporations' cultures and a lot of society. I was just doing a search for a client, and there's a guy who is in the C-suite. He's a chief operations officer, and he's been working remotely for 2.5 years. And he said, you know what? I thought I was happy. I'm not. This is not making me happy, not being around the people. And for the first year and a half or 2 years with my kids and seeing them, I thought I was. But I've been really unhappy, and I've been going to there's a lot of undiagnosed emotional problems that people have for not being in an office, John.
I think that's a good point, and I think that's true. I also think that it's easy to just take a couple of online posts that get 700,000 views and therefore think that means 700,000 people. No, it's a couple people, and we're all talking about it. A lot of the young people I know are busting their butt. They're working hard. And I know some 60-year-olds who aren't. I mean, it really does depend on the individual. So I don't know that I'm a great fan about diagnosing Gen Z with that broad brush. Tom Gimbel is the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. We're talking about a study, or at least a couple of posts that's getting a lot of reaction, and then the writing about it. The folks that don't want to work all day real hard. They want to have a nice life. In fact, 847 said, "Hey, guys, I didn't think of the Gen Z that spoke up as a bad apple. It's interesting that your guest did, the person that wants to work 5 hours a day. I thought companies were also hiring more, you know, almost TaskRabbit-type employees, gig workers in a way, people who will do the job and they're not on the payroll for 40 hours a week. Is that a going thing, Tom?"
No, it's not really. The gig worker kind of fell out when health insurance became something that people wanted to have, and they realized that the salaries and bonuses, it's something that's evolving, and there'll always be people that have that. But the primary source of income, it caps out. There's only, as a sole proprietor, there's only so much time you can bill yourself out for, whether you're driving a car or walking dogs or what have you. And so you realize that your income is maxed out at a certain point. And so there's a certain percent of the population that'll want to do that, but there's also a sense of white-collar workers that tried it, and they realized it's not all it cracked up. You know, working 70 hours a week to make money driving an Uber, you realize that you do have a boss, right? It might not be sitting in a cubicle, but you're still working for somebody, and it's a lot of work to make the kind of money that you thought you were going to make.
Several studies suggest remote and hybrid employees work slightly longer hours. They work longer and harder than remote workers. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I think it really is number one, it's very hard to determine, unless somebody's in your house, how much and how long and how hard you're working. And really the same thing in an office. What we believe is that in an office environment, there's intangible motivators. There's seeing somebody else on the phone. There's knowing that somebody else is busy. There's seeing work product. There's seeing people moving around in conversations that are being had. At home, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are more productive, but that doesn't mean everybody is. And that's what people have tried to turn this into, is that because X percent of people can be productive working autonomously and alone, everybody should. And that's just not the case.
There's also this concept of lazy girl jobs. I guess they could call it lazy boy jobs, too. But one TikTok user's been viewed 1.3 million times talking about lazy girl jobs are my faves. All I do is copy and paste the same emails, take 3 to 4 calls a day, take my extra long break, take more breaks, and get a nice salary. I love my lazy girl job. It's typically a non-technical role that requires little interaction with colleagues and mainly entails repetitive tasks. I guess those are out there. And if it's a 9-to-5 job, but it ends at 5, some people aspire to that. What do you make of that post?
I think Gloria Steinem, is she alive? Would she be rolling over in her grave? What would she be doing right now, John?
This doesn't sound like very ambitious, but that's why I said maybe there are lazy boys out there, too. There are jobs like that out there, and if that sort of meets your emotional and financial need, yeah.
Be wary of extremes, just like in our political world we live in these days. There's somebody who's going to tell you that working 110 hours a week is awesome. And there's going to be somebody that tells you that working 5 hours a day is fantastic. And they're both right for themselves. They're not right for everybody else. And just because, you know, as my dad used to say, if everybody's jumping off a bridge, you're going to jump off a bridge? And I think this is absolutely insane that we get in this clickbait of social media that somebody can make a video and say, a lazy girl job, and they're insulting half the population while simultaneously saying they're unmotivated. Well, I don't think it's insulting half the population, because most of the women I know wouldn't want that job.
I don't think most of the men would either. I think this almost sounds like a second salary, like the sort of thing you can do. And again, I think there's something.
With that, John. I don't agree with that.
But let me finish my thought. I think there's something what we aren't addressing here is at least something very attractive about a job that ends at 5. And you don't have to take it home. It's not hybrid work. And even if it is work from home, it ends at 5. I don't even have to think about it after 5. I don't know what that job looks like, but I'm sure there's some of them out there. And I could see the appeal of that, because now my life starts at 5. Now I'm going to go skydiving, or I'm going to go for a bike ride, and I'm not going to have to think about work.
You know, I tell you, that's like saying when you leave home to go to work, you don't have to think about your family. When you actually care about doing something well, you care about it even when you're not doing it. And if there's somebody who can turn off their brain and figure out how to patent it, they should. But I'll tell you that the bigger issue here is not about turning your job off at 5. The bigger issue is there's a lot of people, and this is where most people can't say this, but I'll say it right here, John, is that a lot of people, they can't show up on time. A lot of people can't manage themselves. A lot of people don't know how to say the right things. A lot of people want to have a job that they can leave at 5, but they don't show up until 15 minutes after their start time. Or they're on their phone during the day when they're not supposed to be. We make it sound like it's either the employer's always right or the employee's always right. And the truth of the matter is, it's both. But to say that every human being who wants a job is a good worker and will show up isn't true.
It's Tom Gimbel, and he knows a little bit about this. He's the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Tom, it's always interesting to talk to you. We appreciate your thoughts today.
I hope the Cubs win tonight. See you later, John.
Stay hydrated. As always, 57,000 text messages after Tom Gimbel comes on. The founder and CEO of LaSalle Network talking about Gen Z, talking about lazy jobs, talking about the work-life balance. 224 said, I work many more hours at home than I ever did in the office, and I work harder as well. Tom wasn't confirming that. 630 said, yes, Gloria Steinem is alive. She just had a cameo on And Just Like That. 214 said, remote work is not lazy. It's a great job for people who must be homebound or have kids. John, I love Tom. He hit the nail on the head. I think I have everything. 847 said, ask Alexa if working 110 hours a week is awesome. Somebody else said, instead of looking for change that nets the best results while benefiting employees, many companies resist the change. But people evolve and workplaces don't. Did Tom complain about computers in 1991? Couple more. John, most people are there for 8 hours, but they're not working for 8 hours. And finally, on a remote work topic, I'm a mom that has 2 kids with special needs. Remote work is ideal for women like me. I definitely work harder, and I definitely work longer. Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest, and he joins us regularly here on WGN today about kind of a stronger-than-expected economy. Huh, Stephen? Good news, right?
Yeah, thank you, John, for having me. Yeah, it's good news. We're the predicted recession we've been hearing about for over a year now hasn't come to fruition, and it doesn't seem like it's anywhere close based on the second quarter GDP numbers. So I think this is all positive. I think we may get that soft landing we've been talking about, and inflation numbers seem to be coming down hard. So I think it's all good. I'm enjoying it.
Is that the definition of a soft landing, no recession, as opposed to a short-lived one?
I think you're right on the line right there. Yeah, you could have a couple of very minor drops in the GDP for maybe a quarter or two, and that would be a soft landing. But it doesn't even look like that's on the horizon. You know, back in January, the consensus of Wall Street experts was a negative 0.5% for Q2 GDP. Now they're looking at 2.4% up. That is a huge miss on the predictions, and that was just a few months ago. So now they're talking 1.7% is the consensus for the third quarter up, as opposed to in the beginning of the year, it was 0.3 down. So many of the world's smartest people were fooled, got it wrong, and investors are trying to react and adjust to that. And I think that's what you're seeing in the market.
What do you think happened or is happening?
As we talked before, you know, over the months and last year or two, I just felt that, you know, the economy was so strong. There were parts of the economy people weren't talking about. For example, the savings rate being up near the 4-5% was something we hadn't seen in 16 years. And with the resilience of the economy going forward, and honestly, when everybody I've learned in my 40 years, when everybody is on one side of the market, get on the other side. And everybody started the year, almost everybody was bearish. And it's turned out to be a pretty good market for those of us who were purchasing stocks. And I think it's going to continue. You may get a little lull in here, maybe, for August and September, but I think it's an opportunity to buy. And if you're going to look out a year, that's what I'm doing, a year and a half by the election, I think you see a really good market later this year and into 24.
What would you be buying?
I'm quite excited.
What would you be buying?
Cyclicals are one of the best performing sectors we've been buying. I like those a lot. I'm a person who likes a dividend when I can get one, and I like low multiple P ratios. I'm more of a value investor. And I think the financials with the inverted yield curve right now are looking attractive to me because I think that yield curve will revert back to normal at some point, and that should be really good for the financial institutions. Those stocks are priced cheaply. Look at the anything having to do with the consumer, I think will do well. But you got to, again, you got to, you know, cherry pick, so to speak. And overall, I think investors, when money markets, which are over five now, come back down probably a year from now, I think investors will start redeploying capital back into the marketplace because that is a nice alternative if you're sitting on the sidelines. But if that breaks down to 4.5, and by the way, I do think the Fed will be lowering rates next year, which will encourage the economy. And I think if you're looking out a year from now, we're going to have a if you're positioned right, I think it could be very profitable for you. I'm kind of excited, if you could tell that in my tone.
Well, you also sound a little cautious, as is everybody, although you also do sound a bit like an outlier here. When you say cyclicals, what do you mean? What are cyclicals?
Anything really affecting the consumer that would benefit from the economy growing strong in those areas, anything from retail. I think almost everything I buy in the cyclical world that I think are just undervalued, underappreciated, and they're getting no respect from the market. And I like buying companies that have no respect, especially because you can buy them cheap and then just wait for them to be discovered or reevaluated down the road.
And if interest rates go down, then do you think the market's going to go up?
I think that, yeah, I do. So I'm not sure if the Fed will raise again. There's a chance they'll raise another quarter point. I don't think so, but you could flip a coin on that one. But I think they're done for the most part. I think they've overshot the runway on raising rates. We haven't seen the full effect of the rate raise because the last couple of months was a lot of the raise. But as you go through into an election years are notoriously good for the market. So, again, I think the Fed overshot the runway so they can lower next year, maybe 0.75 point more than I would have recommended they go. And then next year gives them room to drop 0.75 point or more as we head into, you know, first quarter, second quarter of next year. And I'm a long-term investor, so that's how I'm looking at it.
I wonder what the steps down look like. Would it be quarter point like that, or would it be something more drastic?
That'd be my guess. You know, I prefer a quarter point at a time. That would signal no panic on the Fed's part. So I think it'd be more measured in going into that. I think that's what they'll do. If they have to, they can always lower quicker, but I don't think they're going to need to, as reflected in the economic stats we're getting. The numbers are good. That the fact is they're good. And it's nowhere near as bad as we were told over a year ago, back last summer, how bad things were going to be, and it never materialized.
Over a week ago. I mean, it's just, I'm getting mixed signals. I'm getting mixed signals from you and everyone else. For instance, you just noted that savings rates are up, but I also understand the consumer debt is up, that we're putting more on our credit cards, and we've got student loans coming due. I wonder really how much cash is in hand to continue to propel the economy.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, we're seeing individuals who receive raises over the last year or two because of the low unemployment, and that's not going to go away unless they get laid off. And the layoffs aren't that big in terms of size, and when they do get laid off, they're finding another job right away. So the consumer's in really good shape on all historical levels, and they're just redirecting it to different areas of the economy, which is great. And I think, you know, China's got to come back at this point. China's still not rebounding the way it should. All of that combined, I think, again, people are sending mixed signals, and I don't want to be sending one, but I'm very bullish. I'm just saying short-term, we could be seeing an opportunity to buy if you're not in the market. And sadly, many people are not because, again, the predictions in the beginning of the year were so negative. So many investment firms, it's the second half and they haven't performed. They're going to want to be in this market to perform as we go forward. And so you could see a lot of buying in the last half of the year, especially by money managers who missed it. And as you head into 2024, as confidence returns, and if we miss the recession, then you're going to see more confidence, and it'll start to build on itself. And then in the end of the year, if you start to account where interest rates are falling and the money markets are no longer paying over five, maybe paying in fours, that'll trigger more buying. So I see a possible really bullish scenario next year, even later this year, unless something comes out of left field. God forbid a 9/11 type scenario, a COVID type thing. If that doesn't occur, people are underinvested in this market and they're parked in money markets, and I think that will change.
I got to run, Stephen, but I did ask this question to one of our guests earlier this week or late last week, and that was, do you think that an unforeseen scenario would include the results of the next presidential election, or do you think that the economy is stable enough, we're not going to see the wild swing you're talking about wouldn't somehow be triggered by the results of the next presidential election, would they?
No, I'm looking for that sooner than that as you head into the election. Now, after the election, we don't know. All bets are off. It depends on where the market is as you head into the election. I look at the values today. We've had a big run. Like I said, we're getting a sell-off here, which I think is actually healthy. You get some people a chance to get in here in the next month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you rally into the new year, but I'll be changing a lot of things, getting more defensive as we go into the election, hopefully with a lot of profits booked, and then we'll take it from there.
Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Real estate company Jones Lang LaSalle is unloading some of its own real estate. The company is preparing to sublease a portion of its headquarters at Aon Center. Crane says Jones is marketing about 61,000 square feet on the 47th and 48th floors, or about 30% of its total space. Jones Lang LaSalle, like other companies, doesn't need as much space as employees work remotely. Available downtown Chicago office space surpassed 8 million square feet so far this year. That figure was about 6 million last year and 3.3 million at the start of the pandemic. New home sales in the Chicago area had their best spring since 2008. Low home inventory helped drive demand. Builders sold 1,438 new homes in the second quarter, an increase of 38% compared to a year ago. Current data from home builder consultant Tracy Cross and Associates says that's the largest number of second quarter sales in any year since 2008. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And this is an exciting time of year, isn't it, Big O?
Oh, yeah. And not only all over the state, but all over the country, because it's county fair time.
Including the McHenry County Fair, which begins today in Woodstock. More from our living legend after I thank the Chevy Silverado HD for being our sponsor. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, Orion, how are you? How's retirement treating you?
Well, retirement is treating me well, and Gloria is taking good care of me.
Yeah, the wife who saved your life, as you've often said.
Yeah, right.
We'll check back in with Orion later, but just down the road from his home in Huntley is the McHenry County Fair in Woodstock. It begins today, and Rich Tobias is vice president of the McHenry County Fair Association, and this is number 75, Rich.
Yep, the fair has been around since 1854, but they took a break during the World War, so 75 years at the same location. Some things are the same, some things are different.
Let's start there then. What's the same and what's new?
Well, we're still a big country fair with a lot of animals. We don't have quite as much dairy as we used to have. We're more beef right now. We still have a big poultry show. What's new is last year, for the first time, we had alpacas there, and they'll be back this year. So that's a little bit different. 4-H is still huge in McHenry County. Not only animals, but that's changed a lot too, because they have rocketry and shooting sports and all kinds of things that 4-H never was before. So carnival rides are the same. And of course, we're a big food festival.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much anything you can imagine eating, you can probably find at the county fair. And a lot of it is on a stick. Something else that's new this year is a new main building at the McHenry County Fair, which will be christened the Orion Samuelson Meeting Hall. How about that, Big O?
Yeah, I'm really honored that I'm remembered in this way, because it'll be there for a long time.
More about the Big O building and about the McHenry County Fair tomorrow. It runs through Sunday in Woodstock. From the farm to your belly, today's National Raspberry Cream Pie Day. I don't think they can put that on a stick. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Here's Larry Chester, the CEO and CFO of Simplified. CFOSimplified.com is the website. Talk to me about this Federal Reserve Program. Larry, welcome back.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here today. You know, I think this is probably one of the most exciting things I've heard out of the Fed in a long time. What they've done is they've gone into the, 21st century of electronic payments, and they've instituted a program that allows for instant money movement between banks, which means instant money movement between businesses. allowing you to pay somebody 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and have the money immediately, instantaneously drop into their account. I mean, talk about immediate transactions. I mean, what a way to do it.
This is the program is called FedNow. They've rolled it out kind of in a soft launch, but it sounds like it works for the banking sector the way Venmo or PayPal works for the rest of us, right?
Well, you know, it's very similar. I think there's an interesting thing. We need to understand the differences here between programs like Venmo and PayPal and Apple Pay and a program like Zelle, which is a different type of thing. When you're dealing with Venmo or PayPal, what they're doing is moving money into their bank, into their account, and then you have to request to move it into somebody else's account. So you don't get instantaneous cash from your account to somebody else's account. With Zelle, if you move money using Zelle, you literally take it from your account and put it right into somebody else's account. There's no intermediary transaction. And that's really what the Fed has done here.
There's no intermediary transaction. You would literally go onto an app that your bank is going to offer and transfer money from your bank account to somebody else's bank account instantaneously. Well, they say there's a 20-second processing, but for me, that's pretty instantaneous, if you ask me.
So, yeah, I think you're starting to describe how I would see this program in place. I don't think and won't think much about how banks transfer assets, but I have been at real estate closings. I have bought a car. I've cashed third-party checks in which they say we're going to put a hold on this for a few days. Would this impact those sorts of things?
Absolutely, because when we're talking about instant transfer of money, we're talking about instantly available cash. So they've put a limit of the transactions so that you can't transfer more than $500,000. But I think that kind of covers any of the transactions that you or I would make, don't you think?
Yeah, right. But I mean, so literally then, the those three scenarios I just described, buying a house or even if you've got a $50 check from somebody, but it's not being drawn on your account and they say, okay, we've now noted that that's in your account, but you don't have access to that for a couple of days, which now that you mention it does sound very 1970s of them, doesn't it?
Right.
That money is...
and that's really the big difference here, is that the cash is instantly available. You know, when I say there's a 20-second delay, yeah. I mean, the 20 seconds is how much time it takes for the bank, for the Fed, to transfer the information back and forth and back and forth until it's confirmed, and then they say, okay, it's there. I mean, I'll wait 20 seconds to get cash in my hand.
And if it's not, and if it's not there, then I guess that would be determined as well. How do I know if my bank is doing this, or how can I sort of encourage this when I'm cashing a check or closing on a house?
Well, I think that, you know, there are only a few banks and credit unions that are handling it right now. There were 35 banks and credit unions that were part of the initial test period, the pilot period that was run that started in 2019. So if you are part of one of those banks, and there's a list that lists most of the banks, that lists all the banks that are on it, it's on the Fed's website, those generally would have an app available to be able to do that. What they're saying is that it's going to be much like doing issuing a check online when you go to your banking system. Now, the other banks that have not done it yet, and I've talked to a number of banks that are kind of in the process of creating the app to be able to do this, they don't have it available. And so you're not going to be able to use that yet until they get an application that you can log on to, mm-hmm. either on your phone or on your website, to be able to do that transaction.
I'm reading from Forbes. The FedNow service is available to more than 10,000 institutions. They can opt into, but they don't have to. So it'll be interesting to see how this rolls in now that it's been rolled out. Larry Chester joining us on WGN's Wintrust Business Lunch, the CEO of CFO and CFO at Simplified. Nice to talk to you, Larry. Thanks for your help today. Very interesting.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.